a major new literacy investment. Curtis Hill runs for Congress. Plus, IUPUI is splitting up and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 19th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb announced a $111 million investment to target Indiana's sliding literacy rate for young readers. The Indianapolis-based Lilly Endowment Foundation will fund most of the effort. The investment will include money for specialized training for teachers and new supports for students struggling to master reading skills. Holcomb said this is a timely response to the academic setback students faced due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
And I'm just so exhilarated, quite frankly, excited to see from kindergarten to fourth grade the impact this is going to have over just the next 5 years.
Leaders from communities, business, and education have voiced alarm over literacy skills. Test results this month found nearly 1 in 5 Indiana third graders lacked fundamental skills needed to become a successful reader. Can this literacy investment be transformative for Indiana's youth? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and O'Shea Boyd, public engagement editor for the Indianapolis Star. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Lee Schrock, about 82% of students passed the most recent statewide learning exam. Holcomb says he wants that to be 95% by 2027, just 5 years away. Is that a realistic goal?
You know, I'm not sure. And, you know, I'm happy to see us funding more towards literacy rates for youth, but this didn't happen overnight, and it's not going to change overnight. I'm very happy to see that the governor and the state is going to start repairing some of the damage done after dismantling our public schools over the last dozen or so years. So yet to be seen, happy about the investment, happy to see Eli Lilly weigh in on this, and you know, it won't happen overnight.
To that point about Eli Lilly getting involved, we talked on this show a lot about, you know, businesses complaining about the lack of workforce readiness in Indiana. And a lot of people wondering, and including lawmakers of the State House sometimes wondering aloud, well, okay, what are you doing to help? Is this a great example of the way that the business community should be getting more involved in things like this?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's fantastic. It's the largest investment in literacy in our state's history, and especially coming after the pandemic, like, it's obviously incredibly important. And I think it could be, you know, transformational for us. And on top of back-to-back budgets where we saw record investments in schools, teachers, and students from the General Assembly, and now add on this, which is going to target, you know, a variety of different things, right? Stipends for teachers,
specialized training,
professional development, yeah. Coaches to come into the schools, and targeted services for folks who need it. So anyway, I think it's fantastic, and it's great to see the state and the, you know, the business community and philanthropy come together to make that investment.
I want to ask again about the goal, because that would be an enormous jump in just 5 years' time. I get the value of setting aspirational goals, but is the governor setting the state up for failure?
It wouldn't be the first time. Because if you look at educational goals that have been set on any number of fronts, whether it was we want Hoosiers to have certification, post-secondary certification, a college degree, they're always lofty goals, and I haven't researched it, but I'm pretty sure we are not there and are not going to get there. And I could probably find all the way back to former Governor Bob Orr and the A-plus program for educational excellence, which had a lot of goals built into that program in the late 80s. You got to have something to shoot for. I think as many Hoosiers would say, the goal should be 100%. I mean, that's the more laudable goal. And then if you can't get there, then figure out why not. So I understand setting the goal. I'm not sure how realistic it is because, again, these are some issues that have certainly the pandemic exacerbated problems, but I think many of the problems were there. The good news here, again, is, yes, it's great to see everybody come together. How often does a governor get to be the front man and take credit, quote-unquote, for something that he's only ponying up a portion of the money for? So good kudos to him for a nice political hit. But I think the old expression about giving somebody a fish, you know, feed them for a day, teach them to fish, feed them for a lifetime. And I think there was an allusion to this a moment ago. This is about setting up researchers to study the best practices for teaching reading and what works, what doesn't. The coaching, you're not just teaching the current crop of teachers to be better in the moment. You're teaching people how to teach teachers to be better. So it really is, I think, more of a continuum. And while it may not deliver the results in the short term, I certainly applaud the effort and hope that it can meet the 95% and exceed it en route to 100% in the not so distant future.
Yeah, we always talk about, you know, whenever, whether it's the government or the nonprofit sector or the two of them spending a bunch of money, we always talk about, okay, well, how are we going to know whether we were spending it the right way? Well, the obvious target here is, are literacy rates going to improve? Is any improvement in just 5 years' time going to be, okay, hey, this is good news? Or do we really have to make a significant jump for people to look at this and go, this is money well spent?
I think any improvement will be an improvement. My concern, though, is that we keep setting these goals. And like you said, we don't, have we ever reached these goals? I don't know. I am happy to see that it's a statewide effort. I'm happy to see that businesses are involved. But as a former education reporter, I've seen when we focus on literacy, math slides off. Then when we focus on math, literacy falls off. So my concern is, are we going to focus on literacy and then we're going to see a drop in math scores, and then we're going to have this same thing come up in a couple years about, oh, we need to do something about our math scores now. It's never, I've never seen it be kind of a focus on both at the same time to make sure our students are ready. And there's going to be a new cohort, if I could say the word, cohort of students too. Yeah. So the group that will be testing soon won't be the same group in the next 5 years or so. So then what's going to happen with those students?
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, 82% of Indiana students passed the 2022 statewide reading exam. Governor Holcomb wants that to be 95% by 2027. Is that realistic? A yes or B no. Last week, we asked you, speaking of Eli Lilly, does Eli Lilly's criticism of Indiana's abortion ban have any practical effect? 49% of you say yes, 51% say no. Not sure what I expected, but it wasn't something that close. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, former Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill, who criminally battered four women while in office, is one of 12 Republicans vying to replace Congresswoman Jackie Walorski, who died in a car crash earlier this month. A Republican Party caucus this Saturday will choose a candidate for the remainder of Walorski's term, which ends this January, and for the full two-year term that directly follows it. They will run in a special election being held on the same day as this fall's general election. Curtis Hill was elected Attorney General in 2016, but in 2018, four women, including a state lawmaker, said he drunkenly groped them during a post-legislative session party. Hill refused to resign and denied the allegations, but in 2020, the state Supreme Court suspended his law license for 30 days, ruling he had criminally battered the victims. Shortly thereafter, he lost his party's renomination to current Attorney General Todd Rokita. Other Republican candidates for the 2nd District seat include State Representative Kurt Nisely, former Representative Christy Stutzman, and Rudy Yakim, a former Walorski staffer who has been endorsed by Walorski's husband and mother. Jennifer Hollowell, does Curtis Hill make a comeback here?
I don't know. You know, caucuses are very interesting. Anything can happen, and it's up to the 500 or so precinct committee people, whoever shows up of that number. And, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, there are 11 candidates. There are a lot of folks in the field. And Curtis Hill, obviously, you know, former prosecutor there, well known. But how much of a cloud is going to hang over his head given, you know, multiple allegations of harassment and then, you know, the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court suspending his license? It's a pretty serious issue. But politics is interesting, and so we'll see what those precinct committee folks decide.
Yeah, this is not going before voters at large, in which Curtis Hill's name recognition arguably helps more than it does in a district caucus, where
these are all, for the most part, politically plugged in people, and so probably, hopefully, know every name on that list. Is this, in that way, in this very hard to read environment of a district caucus, is that his best chance at making a political comeback?
I mean, it shouldn't be. This should be a space of accountability. He has shown not only in his policies and the way he leads that his policies are dangerous for Hoosiers, but he is dangerous for Hoosiers in the workplace. And there needs to be accountability. There needs to be accountability. I say this a lot across politics as an arena when this type of stuff occurs. But to see someone like this, if he fails up into this spot and there's no accountability from the Republican Party on this, that is a failure.
Given the large pool, although I note that 12 candidates, one woman, to succeed one of the only women in Indiana's congressional delegation, what will this tell us about the state? Does this tell us something, if Curtis Hill wins this caucus, does this tell us something about the state of the Indiana Republican Party at large, or something about the specific congressional district and these however many 500-some people who show up?
Probably both. Probably both. It would definitely tell us that they don't really care about women and how women feel in the workplace. Holding him accountable is what the party needs to do. It would also show that he still has a lot of friends who back him, and that's a little concerning, being that he was charged with actually harassing women.
There are some obviously locally notable names, but some notable names on the statewide level. Christy Stutzman, of course, a state representative in her own right, as well as the wife of former Congressman Marlon Stutzman. Kurt Nisely has gained quite a bit of notoriety, let's say, over the years in the General Assembly. And then you have Rudy Yakum, a name that I imagine a lot of people don't probably know who aren't more plugged into politics, but who was endorsed by Jackie Walorski's husband and mother. Do you think something like that can vault him into the winner's seat?
I do. I actually think, because of the circumstances under which this position came open, this seat came open, there's going to be, I think, that desire on the part of a lot of people to defer, if you will, to the wishes of the existing staff, the family, the surviving spouse, you know, all of whom I presume more or less, I don't want to say everybody on the staff has endorsed Rudy Yakum, but let's
And not just a random, like, okay, we're going to pick him. A former Walorski staff.
Right, exactly. I think, you know, a lot of times these, not just in Indiana, but look at congressional seats. Anytime seats open, oftentimes it's a relative. Mm-hmm. It's a chief of staff. It's somebody who can, it's almost as if it's sort of, all right, continue to carry the torch, carry on, keep the memory alive. It's almost a sense of propriety, the right thing to
continuity
do.
Maybe.
Continuity. Again, you make a good point, though, because since this is not going to voters in general, you don't know what kind of political IOUs are going to be collected, what kind of alliances that we'll never know about that have been forged over the decades, and how those might shape things. I would have to assume, though, that because of the endorsement of Jackie Walorski's surviving spouse and the note, the connections to Walorski personally and her staff, that's where I think that's the smart money bet right now. The funny thing, it seems to me, not funny, certainly it's a tragic situation, but normally you have precinct committeemen and district officials coming together to say who might stand a good chance, you know, of preserving that as a Republican seat. And in this case, that's off the table. It could be, I assume, any of the 11 or 12, and probably could win as a practical matter. So, I mean, that normal consideration is not even around.
The other tricky part with a district caucus or a precinct caucus is, you know, who are the people who happen to be those precinct committee people? Like, we saw Diego Morales able to make a major move at the Indiana Republican Party convention to oust the incumbent, but that was a coordinated effort that took place across an election in order to get the people in place who could then deliver him a victory. You don't have the same situation here, where obviously this was sudden and tragic and, you know, heartbreaking. And so now it's, well, who was already there? Who are these people interested in? Who are they loyal to? It's going to be, and with 12 candidates, it's that's potentially a lot of ballots on Saturday.
And the way that process goes, the list is locked. So, you know, in other processes, you have time to appoint precinct committeemen that you like, and county chairs can do that in this process.
It's locked in.
A lot of times,
there's a motivator of, you know, anger or frustration. When there's somebody leaves under different circumstances, you say, I didn't like that, and you didn't like that. Here's what we can do to change it. That's not going to happen this time around. So you have to fall in line, essentially, to say, I'm there to continue to carry the torch. Count on me to do so.
All right. Indiana University and Purdue University recently announced a vision to split IUPUI into two separate institutions. The campus will be known as IU Indianapolis by fall of 2024. IUPUI is owned and operated by IU with certain programs that grant Purdue degrees. Moving forward, both universities will govern their own programs and still collaborate to form a new Bioscience Engineering Institute, which IU President Pam Whitten says will combine Purdue's biomedical engineering with the IU School of Medicine.
We view this as an opportunity, frankly, to make a statement to the whole country that Indiana is the place to come to get training, to start a company, or to hire people in the fields of biohealth engineering.
IU will retain certain administrative responsibilities for both institutions, the School of Science and Athletics. Purdue will assume responsibility for engineering, computer science, and technology. Both universities plan to form working groups in the coming months to work out details on the transition. O'Shea Boyd, will this be positive for Indianapolis and Indiana?
I have no idea. I surely hope so. I assume so. I assume they came to this decision because it will be, but this just seems like it was poof out of thin air. There was no discussion when you had the whole splitting of IPFW. There was discussion, I believe it was for years, controversial for years, still split apart, but at least there was input. We haven't had any input, just came top down, this is what's going to happen. So there are a lot of questions. A lot of questions, a lot of questions for faculty, employees. How are they going to be divided up? What happens? One of the things that came to my mind immediately was IUPUI, Madam Walker, that connection. What happens to the Madam Walker Legacy Center? What happens to neighborhoods? What happens to so many things that we have no answers to? And I believe they're going to try to have it done within 2 years.
Yeah.
So that's a lot to happen within 2 years. And input from who is going to also be a part of this? You know, that's a big concern. Will the community be a part of this? Will the state, you know, how are we going to figure this thing out? Is it just going to be the trustees, the presidents? Who's doing this? It's a lot. I think we deserve some answers, for sure.
This is the second time in just a few weeks now that we have questions about the transparency going on at Purdue University, which is that Mitch Daniels announced suddenly, oh, I'm leaving, and here's the guy who's going to replace me, with no public warning that that was going to happen, or input as to who his replacement would be. And now you have what's been reported is that Mitch Daniels has been interested in this for a long time and never found a willing partner in Michael McRobbie at IU. Well, Michael McRobbie is gone. Pam Whitten is now there as the head of that university, and he found a more willing partner. But again, as O'Shea just said, this all seemed to come out of nowhere. So is the spotlight on Purdue getting brighter in a way that's not great for Purdue?
Well, it pains me to say this because as an IU grad myself and a loyalist whose three kids went there, who met his wife there, I got credentials as an IU guy, okay? And a fan of Purdue. That's a rare cross, by the way. I love our research institutions. They've been a tremendous benefit to our state. But neither has been in recent years a standard bearer for transparency. Look at Pam Whitten's ascension to her current position as president. You know, there was a lot of friction within certain factions within the faculty, including folks I know very well on the law school faculty and others, saying this is not the way things are supposed to be done. You know, she was a candidate that was not, to a large extent, supposed to have the job. And there was just a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering that leaves a bad taste in my mouth, certainly. And because we should be better than that. Our research institutions should, they embrace shared governance, and it should be
public institutions.
Public, oh yeah, public institutions, especially of this kind of profile. Let me just say this, and I don't know, smart people say it's going to be great. The chamber loves it from an economic development standpoint. Tech companies like it. I don't understand it, frankly, because you look at computer science, you mentioned For instance, the School of Science, IU will take that over except for computer science, which will go to Purdue, and yet in the next paragraph, maybe the same paragraph, next sentence in the release from the university said, and yet the Luddy School of Informatics, which my son is a two-time graduate of that, has a master's in that as well, is computer science, informatics, and in computer engineering, and yet it's going to go to IU. To me, uninitiated guy sitting here, doesn't make a lot of sense. Let me close by saying we should thank the tremendous leadership that IUPUI has had over its 50 years, Jerry Bebko, others, Nasser Paydar, who was the most recent chancellor, executive vice president. The week that this was announced, or at least within 7 days, I don't know if it was the same calendar week, he was confirmed as assistant to U.S. Secretary of Education for post-secondary education in the Biden-Harris administration. Deserves it. Great guy.
There are reasons. I mean, we talked about what this can do for Indiana. You know, you have Pam Whitten and Mitch Daniels talking about making this, helping make Indiana a destination for the high-tech jobs of the future, and hopefully this will do this. But this is another reason, as Rashia talked about, there's a lot that needs to be worked out in terms of who's providing input, what's going to happen to these employees, these
Indiana
students.
Indiana Avenue is a cultural corridor that has been encroached on for years, and we need to make sure that we see that maintained. So they need to have a say in this.
And all of that matters, obviously, to the people who are already here, but it also matters to what message this is going to send to prospective students across the country and across the world. If this is not a good process, what is that going to say to people who are thinking about coming to whatever this new university is going to be?
Well, the process is just starting, and so I'm sure it will be all worked out smoothly. I'm sure they've had a lot of, you know, behind-the-scenes conversations in the pre-planning, but, you know, we have a lot of time now to work out all of the details. I look at this, frankly, and think that this is a positive. Number one, you have both of these wonderful universities reaffirming their commitment to Indianapolis, to the capital city, and I think, frankly, for both of them, it will elevate their kind of role and brand in Indianapolis and attract more and new students to Indianapolis for whether it's science, computer science, technology. They're going to elevate that, I think, for both universities, which I think overall is really good for, you know, not only the education of the folks here, but for our need to kind of train the workforce of the future. I think we're going to see more people and better things come out of it.
I know a lot of folks at the former IPFW who think there are reasons to be concerned about how this will all go down, and we've talked about some of that, but is there also reason to be excited about what this could be for the capital city?
Sure, I think so, and I agree. There is so much potential here to have something really grow from this. Again, I just, you know, we look at the history of that area of our city and how black cultural districts were completely dismantled to use that land. So we need to make sure we're not only repairing that, but moving forward in a way where everybody has a seat at the table and we're fixing what happened in the past and moving forward in the future so that when all of these students come to the capital city, they have a rich experience that is authentic to the culture of our city.
Well, and to your point really quickly, IUPUI made a commitment to give scholarships to students who were displaced mm-hmm. when IUPUI was built. So what happens to those things? You know, what happens to athletes who are, where are they going, who are committed to IUPUI or are looking at IUPUI? So there, I hope it works out. I think it will work out, but there's just a lot of questions. So as a journalist, that's what I'm about, is figuring out all the, finding all the answers to the questions that I have.
All right, there's a new number two man in the Indiana Senate Republican Caucus, Senator Chris Garton, is the new majority floor leader, replacing Mark Messmer.
Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray announced the change in leadership in a press release without explanation for why Messmer was replaced. Bray noted that Messmer will remain a member of the caucus and continue as chair of the Environmental Affairs Committee. Messmer recently split with the majority of his caucus during the abortion ban debate. He voted against the bill in the first Senate vote and then didn't show up for the final vote on the ban. Chris Garton, a Republican from southern Indiana, is finishing up his first term in office. Bray says he elevated Garton to the number two position in the Senate because of his strong leadership abilities and principled common sense approach. Garton is a Marine who served in Iraq and owns a small business.
John Schwanes, can you read anything into this other than fallout from the abortion debate?
If there is something other, a factor at play here, it's not obvious to me. And again, I mentioned earlier, this didn't seem Rod Bray-like, in terms of punitive action. It just doesn't seem to me to be his style. But there has to be consequences, just like elections have consequences. And when you're trying to herd a caucus, and a caucus that is, as certainly we saw on the issue of abortion, as I don't want to say splintered, but it's not monolithic. You've got, and if you're going to retain your leadership role, you have to do something and send a signal to those who don't toe the line.
At least very quickly, how does this impact the Indiana Senate?
Well, it's not good, right? If you're replacing someone who had a dissenting voice on an issue that has splintered your caucus with someone who's just going to say yes to everything you do in a caucus that is increasingly becoming more extreme and right-wing, it's not good for Hoosiers, because that's not the breakdown of the Hoosier state. Right, we can't just have that one mindset. Good policy comes together with a number of different voices working together to create something that respects and reflects their constituents.
And you know, when Rod Bray became the Senate President Pro Tem, he did it in conjunction with Mark Messmer. It was bringing together what a lot of people thought were the two factions of the Indiana Senate caucus to say, okay, here's me, you know, here's Rod Bray representing this faction, here's Mark Messmer as a team. What does this do to that? We'll find out in the future. But that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Oshia Boyd of the Indy Star. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelist. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.